Good evening. Thank you, John, for that introduction. I might just add something to what John said. I am a long-standing theosophist, but I have been known to sit down on occasion. Over the years, I've given a number of talks on the topic of reincarnation. Tonight's talk is a little bit different. You might say it's a reincarnation of all those previous talks. For when you look at that topic, there's a number of ways that you can approach it. You can talk about some of the common objections that people have to the theory of reincarnation. Or you could do a talk on the evidence presented, you know, the available evidence for reincarnation. But tonight, it's about the growth of the soul, how reincarnation serves the growth of the soul through a period of many incarnations. And I know this being a theosophical audience, many of you are quite familiar with the idea, and probably most of you have long ago accepted that idea, but you know, occasionally there's somebody that isn't quite sure, and this afternoon I had a conversation with Mike. Mike is on staff here, and Mike surprised me. He says, "Dave, I don't believe in reincarnation." I said, "Oh?" And he says, "Well, I used to, but that was before in my past life." So, you know, Mike can change his mind. That's okay, Mike. You're allowed to do that. All right. Reincarnation, the word, is based on the Latin incarnatus, which means to incarnate. The word incarnate means to give form or substance to make manifest, to become embodied, especially in human form. And the prefix re, also from the Latin, simply means back again or back anew. Hence, reincarnate, to reincarnate, to come back again in bodily form. Now, enough of channeling John Elgiel. If I were to walk around a room and ask each one of you, where do you think the concept of reincarnation came from? What part of the world? I would guess that many of you would say India, because it's a great part of the Hindu religion. Hindus believe in reincarnation. That's a well-known fact. And it's also a part of certain schools of Buddhism. So if you said India is where reincarnation comes from and spread out to the West and other parts of the world, you'd be right. But it's not exclusively known to India. Reincarnation has been found in other lands as well. It has been found amongst the folklore of the Australian Aborigines. And as you well know, it was part of the Greek philosophers' topics that they talked about. Even certain Native American tribes, evidence is found that some of them believed in reincarnation. When Julius Caesar was fighting the Gauls, well, actually that was what is now known as France, but he was fighting the Druids in ancient Gaul. He noticed what fierce fighters they were, very brave warriors. They put up a fierce resistance. He asked about that, and people that were familiar with the area said, well, these people, the Druids, the reason they're such great fighters is they're not afraid to die. They believe in reincarnation, that if they die in the field of battle, they'll come back again. And indeed, that's one of the great benefits of reincarnation. When you understand it, it really removes a lot of the fear of death. So reincarnation is found not only in India and Tibet and Southeast Asia, but in all parts of the world throughout all times. But today, based on Gallup polls done consistently over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years, in this country at least, 1 out of 5 Americans profess to believe in reincarnation. 20% of the American population tells Gallup that, yes, I believe in reincarnation. And this has been pretty much consistent over the last 20 or 25 years. But you can go back in time. I mentioned the Greek philosophers. For example, Pythagoras, at his great school in Crotona, he certainly taught the doctrine of reincarnation. The great Greek philosopher Plato, in the Academy, reincarnation was also a part of his worldview. And then you can move forward to more recent eras. The German writer from the 19th century, Goethe, and the German philosopher, Schopenhauer, both were advocates of reincarnation. You can look at poets and literary people. Go back to ancient Rome, the first century BC in Rome. Virgil, the great poet who was known by the Aeneid, which is still published and read today. In the Aeneid, you find references to reincarnation. Moving forward to modern times, Walt Whitman, the American poet, William Wordsworth, the great English poet of the Romantic era, they too, you can find in their poetry lines that suggest or flat out say reincarnation. For instance, Walt Whitman, the American poet who made free form verse very popular, he has a poem that many of you have heard, or at least have heard the title of, Song of Myself. Song of Myself has a line that goes, "And as to you, life, I reckon you are the leavings of many deaths. No doubt I have died myself 10,000 times before." Walt Whitman. Going back a little bit before that, William Wordsworth, a great English poet, one of his longer poems, Ode, Intimations of Immortality. In that poem, Intimations of Immortality, there's a great line that many of you have heard. This stanza begins, "Our birth is but a sleep and a forgetting. The soul that rises with us, our life star, hath had elsewhere its setting and cometh from afar." But you don't have to just look to poets and dreamers and literary people and philosophers to find reincarnation. Many practical, down-to-earth, hard-boiled business people, military people, diplomats also believe in reincarnation. A few examples: Benjamin Franklin, one of the founding fathers. Henry Ford, the great industrialist who started Ford Motor Company. In the military field of World War II, General George Patton. All these individuals believed fervently in reincarnation. Let's be clear. When we talk of reincarnation, we have to be clear about what it is that reincarnates. We talk about reincarnation. What is it that reincarnates? Well, as theosophists, you know, it's not the body, it's not the temporal part of us, it's not the personality. We know about that. There's certain things that fade, that we drop at the end of a cycle, a life cycle, but part of us remains. That's the immortal part. You might say we have a lower and a higher self. St. Paul said we have a threefold division, body, soul, and spirit. Obviously, the body dies. The soul and the spirit are the part that remains. There's a great play, a 1936 Pulitzer-winning play that some of you may have heard, You Can't Take It With You. Later, Frank Capra, a couple of years later, turned it into a great movie with Jimmy Stewart, Lionel Barrymore, and Gene Arthur. There are things that we can't take with us. We can't take our body with us. We can't take our accomplishments, our status, our wealth, our money, our material possessions. We can't take all of that. But there are things we take with us, and that those things are immaterial, but they're very important, and they reside in our higher self. Now, that part of us which fades away, the temporal part, includes, obviously, the physical body. It's the first thing to go. Between the physical and the astral body, you have the etheric body or the etheric double, called a double because it resembles the shape of the physical body. Within 24 to 48 hours, in most cases, that disintegrates. That serves as a connecting link between the higher and lower vehicles. When the physical body is gone, there's no need for an etheric double. It has served its purpose. It disintegrates into the ethers. Then we are left with our emotional nature and our mental nature. And as we progress on the other side, as we withdraw from worldly life, we let go of these attachments. And there's a purgation, a purification process that takes place. And eventually, after a long period of time, we're left with our essential nature, the higher self. Or, if you want to use technical Sanskrit words found in some of the theosophical literature, Atma, Buddhi, Manas. Atma, the universal spirit. Buddhi, the vehicle of Atma, the receptacle of Atma, that which gives us individuality and the base of our intuitive faculties. And manas. Manas is a Sanskrit word, comes from the root word man, M-A-N, meaning to think. Manas, we are a thinking entity. Man is a thinking entity. We are rational beings. There is a part of our mind that stays with us. That's part of our individuality. That's who we truly are. But much of what we are involved in a day-to-day living, eventually we let go of, we come detached from it. Just as years ago, you may have memories that are fading, and eventually you won't even recall things that happened 10, 15, 20 years ago. So too, as you pass on, you let go of all the particular events from the past life. But let's be honest. We talk about the higher self. We talk about the spirit and the soul. But let's be honest. For the most part, including myself, I think most of us identify with the personality. I mean, how can we not? We identify with such things as our gender, whether we're male or female. Some people aren't quite sure. Our looks, whether we're handsome, attractive, heavy or thin, tall or short. We identify with our age. When we're young, a child, everybody looks, we're so conscious of how small we are and how big the adults are. Later, we go through a period of adolescence and we're not sure of life. We're trying to find our way. Later, we go into adulthood, the maturity of adulthood, and finally, old age and frailty comes as the body wears down. So we identify with those factors. Also, throughout our whole life, we have various roles that we play. At one time, we might be a student. At another time, a teacher. We might be a mother or a father. If we work for somebody, we might see ourselves as an employee or a worker. If we have our own business, we see ourselves as an employer or a businessman or a businesswoman. And very important, too, as far as things that influence us, how we see ourselves, is our nationality. Very important. We may think that we're above it, but in each country, especially countries of a large size, countries that have had a long existence, there are in the mental atmosphere thought forms that have been building up for hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years. The collective thought of that people, that culture, and it exerts a very subtle but undeniable influence on the people that live within that geographical area. And just geography itself has an impact on how we see ourselves, the options we have. For instance, do you not think that there would be a difference between people growing up in large urban centers such as Beijing, London, Sao Paulo, New York, Los Angeles, people growing up in those areas versus relatively remote areas like, let's say, the northern tip of Alaska, the outback of Australia, North or South Dakota on the plains? Very different approach to life. So all these factors exert an ongoing influence on how we see ourselves day to day, hour by hour, minute by minute. So all that is to say, what do we really know of our soul? We read things in the books. We have an intellectual understanding of it. Perhaps the nearest we can come to understanding what a soul is in our deepest moments of meditation or contemplation. What do we know of the soul's consciousness, of its past lives, how it looks at the past lives? Now, it may sound like I'm talking about the soul as something different. It is not, really. People say often, I think I have a soul, or I believe I have a soul. That's actually topsy-turvy. It's upside down. You are essentially that part. That is who you are, and you have a body. But we become so identified with the body, we say, well, I have a soul. It's out there somewhere. I don't know. It might be up here on stage somewhere. Let me see. No, the soul is who we are. And this body that you and I have, that is a temple. It is a vehicle. It is a sheath. We are using it on a temporary basis. And that soul is conscious. It has consciousness at a much higher level than this day-to-day living level that we are operating at. In effect, what the soul does when it takes incarnation, it takes a part of itself and drills down through the more material planes, the mental plane, the astral plane, down to the physical level, so it works through the brain consciousness. It's just a small part of it. It's like an outpost. But the corporate headquarters is up there. And as long as we are playing these roles that are assigned to us by karma, we can only have a bare inkling of what our fuller consciousness is like at that level. Of course, we will experience that after death at some point. A couple of miscellaneous points I want to make before I get into how the soul grows. I think it's important to touch on these just to clarify any misconceptions. Number one, human beings take rebirth always in human form. I'm aware that some people think if you're a really bad person, if you've been really evil, you're going to come back as a pig, a frog, a cockroach. No. Theosophical teachings say unequivocally, without any exception, when you reincarnate from a human being, you come back as a human being. Number two, there is a cycle of birth and death. It's a long cycle lasting hundreds of years in most cases. Quick rebirth is the exception. It does happen, but it's the exception. The normal cycle may last hundreds, a thousand, maybe more. That depends on various factors. I'm not going to go into that because that would take up too much time. But there is no fixed length between lives. It depends on a lot of factors. Primarily, it depends on how one's life has been lived, how rich it was, and so forth. The exceptions are generally children that die at a very young age due to illness, tragic accident, or young men that are killed in battle, you know, 18, 19, 20 years of age. Clairvoyant research and empirical research, particularly by Ian Stevenson and people like him, shows strong evidence that people come back under those conditions quite quickly, 2, 3, 5 years, maybe 10 years. But the majority of people spend a long time on the other side. If the cycle of birth and death from start to finish, from the death of this life to the start of a new, let's pick a round number, 1,000 years, the time you're spending right now is probably 10% or less of that whole cycle if you live to be 100. If you live to be 50, 60, 70 years, that's just a small part of it. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And finally, the other point is there's a reason for reincarnation. There's a purpose to it. It's not, you know, one image I don't like is the wheel of life and death, because whenever I hear that, I picture a little hamster in a cage running as fast as he can on that wheel, faster, 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 getting nowhere. If that's your idea of reincarnation, please, there's more to it than that. If that's your idea of reincarnation, you probably think there's no end to it, no purpose. You just keep doing it over and over ad infinitum. But there is a purpose, and it's guided throughout the whole process by the law of cause and effect, by karma. Everything we do, everything we say, our motives are all taken into account. And divine karma accounts for everything that happens in our life, every waking moment. Okay, the growth of the soul. First, I want to talk a little bit about what we mean by growth. You know what we mean when we say a person grows intellectually or a person grows emotionally. It's an expansion of sensitivities, of abilities, of faculties. And through a long series of lives, the soul increases. It grows in terms of, I'll just give you a few things. It grows in terms of understanding. Understanding what? Not understanding technology or world events. No, those things you'll forget. Understanding who you really are. As the Greek oracle said, man, know thyself. That's the real mission. Knowing who we are here embedded in this material world, remembering and knowing that we are a spiritual being. Also, knowing who others are. Once we recognize that divinity within ourselves, we then recognize it in others, and knowing that we are all brothers and sisters. We also grow through trial and error, through experience, through pain and suffering. We become wiser. in living, in the art of living. We gather more and more wisdom. It's a very hard thing to define. But people who are wiser know how to live a good life. A lot of the ancient Stoic philosophers talked about what does it mean to live a good life. The great Cicero wrote a whole essay on that, The Good Life. And the soul grows in powers of expression. Powers of expression depending on what line of evolution that soul is on. There are seven rays, there are seven lines. These are powers that are in latent form in everybody, but they become activated and developed and strengthened in the laboratory of life, right here. They don't just happen up there in the spiritual worlds. There, they're in a germinal state, they're latent. But as we develop those things, that is what we can take with us. We can take that with us, as St. Paul said, lay up your treasures in heaven. All that other stuff we do leave behind, you can't take that with you, so to speak. So reincarnation is simply a process that facilitates this inner growth of the soul. And a couple of last points before I go further. There are no unearned gifts. Many people look at those who have extraordinary capabilities in whatever field, whether it's writing, whether it's in sports, whether it's in creative arts, and they say, that person has a gift from God. We don't believe in gifts from God. We believe, as theosophists, that you and I earn everything that we have. Nothing is given to us for free. You earn it, and you gain it by your own efforts, and they're hard-earned gains. Nothing is handed to you. And it's trite, but truly, there is no free lunch. There is no God that's going to give you a freebie. People that believe that, I don't think they've ever really considered the implications of that, that there's a God who plays favorites. Why are some people given these tremendous gifts and all the other schmucks have to make do with what they got? I mean, that makes no sense to me. What makes much more sense is that each of us earns what we have. And that is also a hopeful attitude to take because then we can further develop ourselves and take pride in who we are. So the person you are, the person I am, is the result of all that we have been and done and seen in a long string of lives reaching far, far back into time. All right, at this point, I thought what I'd do is give you some examples to try to illustrate this point. Real-life examples. Okay, I'm going to mention some names. And to do this, I had to decide on a few areas. I wanted to limit it down. So I'm going to start with the field of literature because I know something about it, all right? And why I'm picking extraordinary individuals, or some might say geniuses, is because it is by looking at geniuses or super extraordinary individuals that we can best see how this growth has occurred. If you look at the average person, we're all pretty much, you know, we have average qualities. And we're growing too, but it's much more slowly. It's like a glacier. You can't quite see it. But if you look at the extraordinary people like Michelangelo or somebody who is just head and shoulders above everybody else in his field, be it a scientist or what have you, that is really an excellent illustration of the idea that the soul grows through reincarnation. Because as I said, there are no gifts. I mean, some people might think that, but I don't think that's philosophically palatable. And I think that's baby talk for people that are insecure. You know, you tell that to children, but when you grow up, you mature and you face life. And let's start off with people who have exhibited great literary skills. You might call them geniuses. Now, a lot of people can write. A lot of people can't write, but a lot of people can write, but maybe they're just average, you know, adequate. They can do the job. But there's a few, and every time, every era, there's a few writers that stand head and shoulders above the crowd. And we know that because we look back and we see that their works, their novels, their poetry, their plays have withstood the test of time. And years and years and decades and even hundreds of years after they have passed, Their works are still read and studied and appreciated. People like Shakespeare, Dickens, Dostoevsky. These people had extraordinary abilities to communicate with words. Now, let's consider some of the elements that are needed for one to achieve that stature in the field of literature. First of all, you have to obviously be a wordsmith. You have to have skill with words, with the language. A lot of people have skill with words, but that doesn't make them great. Secondly, you have to have something else, intangible, originality of expression. You have to be able to say it in a way that nobody else has said it. You can't be a copycat. You have to be original. Also, this is very, very basic. You have to be able to create characters, basic, believable characters, diverse characters, not two-dimensional cardboard caricatures of people, comic book caricatures, but real characters with depth, with feeling that we can relate to. And what do you do when you get those characters? Well, you have to tell a story. You have to develop a narrative. You have to be able to do it with a dramatic effect. And throughout this, you have to have deep insight into the human condition, into the workings of the human heart and the human mind. You have to understand human nature to an extent that most people do not. So, with all this, then you still have to understand how these characters interact. Because in real life, no man is an island. We interact with our family, with our colleagues, with our coworkers. We interact with all kinds of people. And a good, excellent author knows how to convey this on the printed page. And they can also reveal hidden aspects of human nature. They can surprise us. And as an additional bonus, they often are able to paint vivid historical descriptions of a time or era that is long past. So all those components, and probably some more, go together to make a great writer. Now, where do all those skills come from? Do they just plop into the lap? Does it come from hereditary? Is it genetic? I doubt it. Does it come from the environment? Is it a matter of a product of our environment? Certainly not, because you can look at many of these great writers, and they had siblings. They didn't achieve that. These are skills, Theosophy says, that they have worked at for a long series of lives. They had focused on this particular line of development, and that is why they are very good. They have dedicated themselves to this in previous incarnations, in previous lands. They have written poetry. They have told stories. You know, who is Homer? Maybe Homer reincarnated again and is one of these great poets. Some of the Greek poets may be reincarnated later in Europe, in England or France. So when we see a flowering of human potential like that, that is basically an illustration of the growth of the soul, the powers of expression through a long series of lives. Let's go to another field, something that I know little about, engineering. More specifically, mechanical engineering. There's all kinds of engineering, electrical engineering, hydraulics. But I'm going to give you an example from the late 19th century. A man by the name of John Roebling. I don't know if anybody here has heard of that name, but you are certainly familiar with what he built. His crowning achievement in his life was designing and building the Brooklyn Bridge. Has anybody been there? I was just out there a couple weeks ago. We took a boat ride around Manhattan. You go under all the bridges, the Manhattan Bridge. We went under the Brooklyn Bridge. Fantastic piece of engineering. It's beautiful. Now, the Brooklyn Bridge, as you know, obviously connects Brooklyn with Manhattan. In between is the East River. The East River is a very long stretch. In its totality, that bridge is over a third of a mile long. They wanted that bridge because the only way people could get back and forth was to get in a ferry, you know, hop in a ferry and go to Manhattan or vice versa. And they wanted a bridge because it would enhance commerce. It would enable people to get to downtown Manhattan for entertainment and on weekends and a number of reasons. Well, Before this bridge was completed in 1883, they had discussed this for a long time, but nobody had been able to do it because the answer is simple. They didn't have the technology to know how to do it. Nobody was able to come up with a design given current knowledge of building bridges, and they didn't know how to do it. When that was completed, by the way, in 1883, it was the longest suspension bridge in the world. Nothing like it had been tried before anywhere. But John Roebling, he may not have been a genius, but he was certainly an extraordinary engineer. He grew up in Europe, and he got a good education, later moved to the United States, and he built quite a few smaller bridges in the Midwest and other areas. But this was his big challenge, and he accepted that. And you know what? He had an inner conviction that he could do it. Nobody else even wanted to try, but somehow he had a conviction, a firm conviction that never wavered that he could build that. Now, it took years, and it ruined his health, but he did it. And it was dangerous work because I'll give you an example. The first problem in spanning that one-third of a mile was putting into the river two structures that would support the bridge, but they had to put those structures into the water. And into the water below that was the mud. There were layers and layers of mud. So they had to build what was called a caisson, which is an enclosed structure. And they had to drive that down into the mud and pump the water out through forced air. And they kept putting stuff on the top, more and more heavier stuff, until it reached bedrock. And then they pumped all the water out with forced air. And then the workers would go down underneath and work. Well, at that time, they didn't know about decompression and the pressure, what it would cause the havoc it would wreak on the human body, and many workers suffered severe health problems, and even John Roebling, who went down there with the workers, he never recovered from that. So he ruined his health in this project. Now, another problem besides the caissons, the supporting structures for this massive bridge, was trying to find a way to have a cable that would support this massive structure. Current technology had nothing, so he, as a brilliant engineer, he designed what is called a wire rope suspension. It's a big cable, now we're all familiar with this, a big cable composed and is created by taking many thousands of strands of smaller wire and weaving them together in such a way so that when the whole cable in its entirety is large like this, you have thousands of cables, smaller cables, making it very strong and be able to support hundreds and hundreds of tons. Now, his background, as I said, he came from Europe, and as a child, he was very smart. He went to college early, a couple of years early. And the things that an engineer studies are what he studied: science, mathematics. He studied architecture and mechanical and hydraulic engineering. You have to have a certain mind to go into this field. The mind of an engineer is very different from the mind of a poet or a writer. An engineer has to be able to understand the laws of physics and advanced mathematics. He also has to understand properties of building materials, wood, the different kinds of wood, steel, copper, iron. He has to understand all this, what kind of stress they can take, how you can work with it, how malleable is it, at what point will it break. And then he has to have a dream, and he has to be able to translate that dream into a blueprint for the workers to work off of. And so an engineer is a person who finds real practical solutions to real life problems. He did this, and he did this with immense confidence, as I said. But where did that come from? You might say it was ego or hubris. But what if it wasn't? What if this conviction was born of past experience in previous lives? Engineers have been around for thousands of years. They helped build the pyramids. In Rome, they helped build the aqueducts. In Chaldea, in many parts of the world, there were always a need for bridges, especially when militaries were attacking another country. They needed to have bridges to cross rivers, to erect the steeples in Europe, the castles. Engineering has always been around, and there's been ample opportunities for souls who are developing along that line to incarnate in places where they could develop their skills. So I suggest to you that the genius of a man like John Roebling and other engineers is not fortuitous or inexplicable, but it's simply the results of efforts made in previous lives. Okay, so I've given you examples of stellar intellects from the world of literature, the world of engineering. Now, let's go the other way. Let's look at somebody who we might call a failure, somebody who the world calls a loser, a career criminal. Let's take a hypothetical young man. I'm not going to give a name, but this young man is in his teens. You know him. There's thousands like him in every city. Every city has many like this. He probably comes from a broken home. If both parents are there, one of the parents or more, maybe even two of the parents are substance abusers. Very likely the husband is an abuser, inflicts violence not only on the children, on the wife. Or it's basically a dysfunctional family. So quickly he loses respect for authority. And this becomes a trademark as he grows up. He has no respect for his parents. In school, he has no respect for the teachers. And eventually law enforcement, no respect for the police or law enforcement. This creates problems for him in his life. Now, what comes easily to a person growing up in this environment is he learns to lie. He learns to cheat. He learns to do whatever it takes to survive. He starts with petty crimes, small burglary, maybe later carjacking, maybe later embezzlement, all kinds of crimes, murder. And eventually, he's caught, he's tripped up by the law, and he goes to juvenile detention. Maybe he does 3, 4, 5 years in juvenile, is released. His education is shot. He has no skills. He goes back out on the streets. He starts associating with the same kind of people. Maybe he joins a gang. He doesn't even make an attempt to lead a legitimate life. So he becomes hardened. He becomes a career criminal, and he spends a lot of his time in prison. By the time he's 20 or 30, or rather 30 or 40, he's probably spent 10, 15 years behind bars. He becomes hardened. He has no remorse. He shows no guilt for what he's done. Later he will, but not originally. And then he associates. While he's in prison, he's associating with other losers, people like him, killers, liars, kidnappers, murderers, rapists, people like that. That's who he's with, 24/7. And so he talks to these people. He eats with them. He lives and sleeps with them. He doesn't associate with the finer elements of society. He doesn't associate with people that have a positive outlook. So he sees people, as many of these criminals do, as simply someone or to be exploited or manipulated for selfish gains. And so it goes. He gets out on parole, he comes back. He gets out, he comes back. And eventually, at some point in his life, when he's maybe in his 50s or 60s, he has a profound sense of regret that he has wasted his life. He looks back and sees himself as a young man walking down this path and sees how he might have changed, he could have changed, but he didn't. And now here he is, broken in mind and body, and he's probably going to spend most of the rest of his life behind bars, and he has this profound regret. Now, the good thing is, at some point, many of these young men, or at that point they're an old man, they start to take responsibility. They may not admit it, but at least to themselves, they take responsibility for what they did. And many of them will decide that, well, as long as I have to spend the rest of my life in prison, I'm going to study. I'm going to make something of it. I'm going to do something worthwhile. Maybe they try to teach others who can't read. They tutor. Or maybe they go and enroll and take a college course. A lot of prisoners have gotten degrees, master degrees, by studying in prison. Many of them work in the law library and so forth. So how does this soul, this unfortunate soul that the world calls a loser and tries to ignore and warehouse in these prisons, how does this kind of a soul benefit from reincarnation? Well, here's how. That life that he just finished is no doubt a miserable life, and none of us would want to go there. But in his next life, his conscience, by virtue of having gone through this suffering, his conscience will be there to alert him in an intuitive way that what you do has repercussions, cause and effect. That if you break the law, sooner or later you pay the price. What goes around does indeed come around. He won't remember the past life. He won't remember that he spent most of his adult life in prison. But the higher self, the ego, the reincarnating immortal self knows that and remembers all that. And it sends an intuitive impulse to that new young kid in the new life that if you walk on the wrong side, you're going to end up in prison or maybe dead. So he has this advantage. The suffering, the pain that he went through now has awakened his sense of virtue. Now, he will still have the temptations because for his whole life he hung around with those kinds of people. And when you set those kind of impulses in action, they ripple down through time and it comes back to you. But because he has that new awakening of conscience, he will be in a better position to withstand those temptations of easy gains, of quick money, of taking advantage of somebody. And that's how it works. And eventually, if he listens to his inner voice and follows that, the higher self, those old temptations will eventually have no hold on him and they will fade away. And then he will begin to live a normal life. So that's how reincarnation works. So I've given you a few examples, and let's just close this up with a brief talk about what reincarnation means to you and I. What does it mean to us? Well, I think, broadly speaking, reincarnation provides a solid basis for hope. It encourages us to strive to become better. Some people may say, well, I'm 50, I'm 60, I'm in the twilight of my years, why should I bother? With the idea of reincarnation, no effort is lost. It is said that even people who are in the last part of their incarnation, who take up a interest in something, poetry, mathematics, what have you, and if they really take to that, it will be in the next incarnation as an impulse to pursue that line of development. And they will have the opportunity to pursue that. So no effort we make is ever lost, and reincarnation gives us reason to struggle. Life is very hard sometimes. It's very difficult. No one goes through life without some kind of suffering, be it financial, be it physical, mental, whatever. And sometimes it gets very hard and people want to give up. And many people do. We have substance abusers, you know, we have people that hit the bottle, or people just indulge in frivolous pastimes to distract themselves from life. But if you sincerely understand what reincarnation implies, you know that everything you do has a result, and there is no reason ever to give up. And it provides you a basis for hope, a basis for optimism, because your future is in your hands, just as my future is in my hands. And by future, I don't just mean the next 10, 20 years of my life, but all the lives to come. You and I can achieve our dreams, we can achieve our aspirations, because there is no end. Life goes on. Life has no terminal point where everything stops. There is no end to growth. There is no end to evolution. We can't even imagine what we might be at some point. We can only have a vague inkling of what potentialities lie within us because we are so weighed down with the responsibilities and concerns of the present day. But it's a good thing to remove yourself from that from time to time and ponder and try to elevate your consciousness to a higher level. And when you do that, you'll come back to daily life with a renewed strength, renewed vigor, and renewed optimism. Thank you.
Will you take questions, David?
Sure.
We will take questions both from the audience here and people online.
There I don't is know already, if I'll answer them.
I'm sure
you'll take them.
There is one from online right now. Two. Mr. David, that's quite a good title. Would you elaborate on the increased number of child prodigies we are seeing in the last 10 years and their reincarnations, such as Jackie Evancho and Akiane? It as if they are able to remember their previous lives. I'm not sure quite that last sentence.
Okay, well, assuming that there has been an increase in child prodigies, this is only my guess, but I would speculate that if this is true, it's because we live in a time of great opportunity. And it may be part of the greater divine plan that these souls come into incarnation now to offer their gifts, their talents to the rest of the world. I mean, when a Shakespeare or a Whitman or a Wordsworth comes, or even an engineer who designs something useful, we all benefit from the fruit of their labors. So it may be simply that at this time in the world, there's a need for those kind of advanced souls to come in and share the love of their labors with us.
We have another question online, but people here, please hold your question.
They're think all mesmerized. Either that or they're sleeping with their eyes open.
Since growth takes time, do we expect to see more and more brilliant people as time goes on?
The kind of growth we are talking about here in this talk is not intellectual faculties so much. We're talking about spiritual growth. There are a lot of brilliant people who are very evil, who have done very bad things. Bernie Madoff probably was a very brilliant man. He knew how to work his way around Wall Street. He was very brilliant because he knew how to get people to invest in his Ponzi scheme. So brilliance, I think, is an overrated quality.
Sometimes it's nice to throw some science in there. I read about a study where scientists, people that were dying, they allowed them to participate. And consistently when they died, the weight that left them was more than their breath on a consistent basis. In your studies on this subject, did you run across anything like that?
In preparing for this talk or previous talks, I have not. I seem to remember vaguely hearing something to that effect, but no, I can't. It sounds very interesting. I would like to look into that research, but no, I can't say that I have.
I've read that the whole process of reincarnating from a period of time as a soul is not just an individual movement, but rather it is done almost staged with other characters that may in fact become be the members of the family, the children or the parents and so on, that they come in as a group and they do so in order that certain lessons may be used. Mm-hmm. What then is your awareness or knowledge of people who will incarnate that way that may include a very abusive one, a person that reincarnates and lives a very abusive life, abusing, I should say, life in this incarnation? And that's a puzzle to the one or several that are being abused. I would suggest, say, in a family, or maybe a parent, mm-hmm. that determines to abuse one particular child, and by belittling them, by punishing them, by declaring their lack of any value or worth, and yet praise other children and so on. Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. As you know, you've probably heard it said that love is one of the strongest bonds that binds people together. And in books on reincarnation, they invariably say that you are drawn together in a series of lives to those that you truly love. Paradoxically, you are also drawn to those that you hate. hate and love, two sides of the coin. And so it may be that if there was a relationship, an unhealthy relationship in a past life, you may have a particular lesson to learn, but you may learn that lesson with the same person, or it may be a similar type of person who has those similar qualities. Or it may be payback for something you did, and not so much retribution, but maybe it shows you what you need, what you were doing. Karma is not really punishment, but it's more educative. Now, in terms of groups of people, which is what I thought you were referring to earlier, it has been observed by some people that groups of people may reincarnate in mass. For instance, there have been strong parallels noted between the ancient Romans and the British people during the height of the colonial era in terms of their emphasis on the rule of law. The Romans were very, they had a very highly sophisticated legal system. So did Britain. And the kinds of architecture that you see in ancient Rome are mirrored in some of the British architecture. Another example, people have said, look at some of the Greek poets, you know, the playwrights, Sophocles, and so forth. And they see a parallel to later periods in France, or people like Shelley, although he was not French, but he had that feel to him. Or it may be that a country is sort of isolated. Japan, for example, seems to be sort of insular. It just seems, you know, the Japanese culture has been the Japanese culture, even though there's Korea and there's China. It really has sort of, it almost makes you think that maybe for some reason the Japanese people, by and large, have just kept reincarnating in that same land. A lot of that is speculation, although some people have done clairvoyant research, and you can take that for what it's worth. But there certainly are empirical, there is empirical evidence when you point to similarities in architecture or things like that.
So, David, I know you've done a lot of work with prisoners, and you gave an example during your talk about a cycle of growth for whether imaginary or whatever sort of prisoner. I'm wondering, is that something that you find in your work is actually true to life, that there's this youthful period, and you mentioned the age of 50 or so when someone actually does have some sort of experience. Mm-hmm. Were you saying that just for an example, or is that something that you've actually encountered?
Well, it was sort of a hypothetical example, but I drew that from my experience of working with prisoners for, I don't know how many years, you know, 10, 15 years. I see that particularly when they're young, and they go in for the first time or second time, they regret it, and they all swear up and down that I'm never coming back. But you know, you look at somebody who's maybe, you look at their profile on the Department of Corrections, and you see their rap sheet, and you see some of these guys that are older, they have this arrest, they've been in car, you can just see the whole history of it. But I hear, in letters that I get, I hear the most profoundest expressions of regret from the older people. That's not to say that a young person can't turn it around, but young people sometimes are led by their emotions, and they haven't quite matured enough. They may have every intention while in prison to go walk the straight and narrow when they get out. But when they get out, if they don't have a support system, a family, they're going to be back with the same crowd. They're going to be running the streets, and all those good intentions, they're going to forget. I mean, they just, they're not strong enough inside. They have not built enough integrity inside to withstand the environment. But eventually they will if they keep at it.
I think we have another question online. If possible, please say more about the seven rays you referred to in your talk tonight. Thank you.
Very briefly, because I have spoken on the seven rays, but I'm really not prepared to go into that. It is said in theosophical literature that humanity evolves along seven fundamental rays. Ray one, for example, is the ray of the leader, the military person, the CEO. It's a very will-powered ray. You have another ray, the artistic ray. Artists are said to be on that ray, whether they're, regardless of whatever kind of art it is, music, sculpture, painting. And then you have the scientists. I think that's ray three. But you can read all this in a very excellent book by Ernest Wood called The Seven Rays. Or Jeffrey Hodson has a similar book, a little bit shorter, called The Seven Human Temperaments. I would suggest those books. They're available from the bookstore at Quest Books.
I have a question.
It's kind of two questions. I've always been told that I'm a very old soul. So is that because I have to come down here so many times because I don't quite get my lessons the first times? And then what about when you're a new soul or a very young soul? Where have you been all that time that you're, that you haven't been here thousands of times? Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. It's a fair question. Those are relative terms, young and old. Simply, an old soul is one who has had perhaps more incarnations, or perhaps one that has gotten more out of those incarnations, has been able to get the essence out of it. I don't know. There are no more new souls coming into this humanity. Not there haven't been for a long time. But an older soul is known by their wisdom, by their compassion. And what you suggested, that if they have to come back again and again, there's something to learn. Well, there probably is for most of us. But at the same time, the other side of that is, to whom much is given, much is expected. If we have many gifts inside of us, I don't mean gifts from God, but things that we have earned, as we grow, we will want to share those with other people. We don't have to be forced to, we just want to. Good people want to share and help others in any way they can. So one of the reasons coming back is not only to further your own growth, but to help other people, to lend a helping hand to those who need it.
Any other question? Well, while you ponder, maybe I'll take the opportunity. David, you quoted a source, and I think it was in the Christian tradition, where they speak of man as body, soul, and spirit. I was just wondering whether it differentiates and says much about the difference between soul and spirit in that text.
That was St. Paul. St. Paul had the triune, or the threefold division of man, is body, soul, and spirit. The body, we know what that is. That's the vehicle, the temple of the spirit. The soul and spirit are terms that are bandied about, in common parlance. So people use those in loose ways. But more specifically, the soul is that part of us which is individual, the real individual you. The spirit is that part which is not individual, but which is universal. In Indian philosophy, it's the Atma. It is that part which is the same in all humanity, or the Christos, the universal Christ. So soul is an individual thing, and the spirit, which there is a spark of divine in each one of us, that is a universal. That is the highest level within us.
Has anyone pondered some more and come up with any more questions from afar or near? All are sad. Oh, you have one. Okay. One more question.
I'm curious, in your study, what happens during the period of the soul or the life in between lives?
Oh, yes.
What's going on there?
Thank you. I actually meant to talk about that a little bit, so I'm glad you raised that question. I wasn't going to spend a lot of time on it. But since you raised the question, what goes on during those 800 or 900 years or several centuries between incarnations. Number one, the first thing that goes on is a type of purification, a letting go. You know, our personal self is so much involved in the day-to-day activities, the terrestrial attractions and the animal passions, the lust and all that kind of stuff, the animal appetites that we have. So it takes time to withdraw from that. We have cravings, desires. We can't just switch that off like a light switch. It takes time. So there's a withdrawal. And that's actually, in the Catholic faith, they talk about purgatory. So that's analogous to the Catholic idea of purgatory. So that's one part of it. Overall, in a big sense, life is hard, and the period between is a period of rest because you earned it. Life is tough. It requires exertion. And so after that period of exertion on this material plane with our dense physical bodies and all the restrictions that imposes on the spirit rejoices, the soul rejoices that it is free from this heavy body which is requires us to each day to go to sleep for a number of hours. We don't have to worry about feeding this body. You know, how am I going to get food? How am I going to get nutritious food? How am I going to clothe my body? Food and shelter. You know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We don't have to worry about that anymore. And then more importantly is it's a time of retrospect and looking back at the past life and seeing all that we have said and done, how we've interacted with other people and what it all means. Because quite frankly, while we're in the midst of the battle of life, we don't always know what the heck is going on. You know, we're just trying to get through the next day, trying to make it through the week. And you know, there's just too much chaos and commotion. And many times people say it just doesn't make sense. I don't know what it's all about. Okay, that's understandable. But after you die and after a period of time, you are permitted to look back at all that. And you look at it from a very neutral, quiet, reflective standpoint. And you will see it in ways that you have never seen before. You will understand it in ways that you were not able to understand now because you're in the midst of the battle. You're too caught up on it. And as you do that, there are lessons that will be learned. Life is a big school. And you learn those lessons which are incorporated into the immortal soul. And it shows up as in future lives as permanent or innate talents or capabilities. If you're born in a new life and you've been a great writer in the past, when you still have to learn the basic mechanics of writing, but boy, do you pick it up quickly. Child prodigies, learn to play the violin at 7, go to Carnegie Hall at age 12. They've been involved in music before in past lives. That's why they're a child prodigy. And then it is just a blissful, peaceful period without conflict. But first you go through that purgation, that purification. There's a period of reflection, assessing what you've done, harvesting the wheat, harvesting what you have gained from that past life, and then consolidating those lessons into your fabric of your being. And at some point, after ages of time, from within an impulse comes. You know, as above, so below, we relate it to when you have a big meal. Oh, man, I ate so much, I can never eat again. But, you know, if you wait long enough, I'm really hungry. So you're up there. I've had a long, busy life, a chaotic life, a struggles and battles. I don't want to come back. But after you've worked through all that and you've had your period of bliss lasting, who knows, centuries, at some point from within, not coerced on you from outside, there's a natural organic desire for rebirth. I think they call that tanha is the Tibetan Buddhist term for it. But anyway, there's a thirst for incarnation. And then that sets up a whole new series where the soul descends through the various fields of increasing density and lower forms of energy and takes on a new body of clothes. It's just like when you die, you take off your garments. The body is a garment. But then when you want to come back, you assume a new garment. Might be in a different country, might be in the opposite sex, but the soul is the same. It's like an actor goes on stage night after night playing different roles. And a good actor doesn't become a good actor by playing one role over and over. Then you become typecast and stereotyped. A good actor is versatile and is able to play many roles, able to understand human nature in many situations. And that's what we do. We are put into many situations so we can become versatile, so we can live a good life, so that we're not typecast into one type of life.
It's a kind of a strange question, but I believe in the immortality of love. Mm-hmm. The love transcends distance and time. I've always believed that, you know, without any evidence of it. Now, my question to you is this, does the soul, when it comes back, you know, does it look for somebody with that, you know, like searching for someone from another, you know, incarnation in another time? Mm-hmm. Is that clear?
Yes, that's mm-hmm. clear. That's a good question. First of all, yes, I think many people have said love is timeless. It's eternal. And when people come back from a previous life where they have known a great, deep, and intense love, I suppose perhaps they may be searching until they meet the right person. Sometimes you have a deja vu moment, and people just meet for the first time, and they just feel like they've known them. But it doesn't have to always work that way. People can be busy going about their lives, doing other things, starting a career, and then love. They don't have to be looking for it, but it can just come along and surprise you. And you meet somebody, not that you've been looking for it, but it's just like, whoa, where did this person come from? And suddenly you realize how empty your life was. So I think you could be looking for it, or it can just come along unexpectedly, but love will bind you together. Maybe not in exactly consecutive lives, but somewhere along down the line, you will be drawn to those that you love, most certainly.
Well, it looks like we have no further questions, so all are satisfied. Can we show a hand of appreciation?
Well, thank you very much. You've been a good crowd. I really enjoyed the questions. That was good.